Good morning, afternoon, and evening, and welcome to the 8311 Cast, your premier Midwestern-based sports podcast, bringing you all things sports to your beautiful ears. Join your hosts, Kyle Mersch, Mike Ludwig, Ariane Berry, and Wyatt Teeter, as we talk about college basketball, the NBA, the NFL, and of course, our signature segments, Mike's Stupid Rules and Write That Down Predictions, here on episode 258. The Super Bowl happened. It did, and we'll talk more about it later on in the episode when we hit the NFL segment, but I do want to touch on a Super Bowl fun fact that I thought was kind of interesting. There has been four teams that have made it to the Super Bowl and won at least once and have never lost in the Super Bowl. Can you name those four teams? Two of them have one win, the other two have two wins in the Super Bowl, and again, zero losses.
The teams that have made it to at least one Super Bowl and never lost?
Teams that have a 100% win record in the Super Bowl.
Is Tampa Bay one of them?
First guess.
Tampa Bay is one of them. They have two wins and zero losses.
Yeah. The Ravens?
The Ravens are the other two-win team.
Okay. And then it's two one-win teams?
Two one-win teams.
Broncos?
This is not the Broncos.
That was stupid.
That was a weird one.
Hi, Mike.
They're 3-5.
Does it carry over like with the franchise? My guess here would be the Rams. Because if it's the LA Rams, they lost to the Patriots. Never mind.
Yeah, that doesn't. So the St. Louis Rams also did.
They're 2-3,
but it does carry over. Okay,
it does. Yes.
Is this counting like pre Super Bowl championships or no?
No, just Super Bowl standings.
Would it be the Colts?
The Colts? No, they are 2-2.
What about like the? Nope, that wouldn't work.
No, it's only a. Saints?
Yeah, the Saints. The Saints is one of the one-win teams. And then the other one is... Start with the same letter.
The C... Nope.
Not the Seahawks. They didn't run... They should have run at the one-yard line. Then they'd be in this list.
Let me rephrase. The New Orleans Saints have the same starting letter as this other team.
New York something or others? Yeah.
The Jets are also 1-0 in the Super Bowl. What?
One or three or something?
Three. It couldn't be one. Two or three.
One was Chiefs, the Packers, I think. So
yeah, it was Packers. Yeah.
But yeah, Joe Namath.
Yeah, who's Doug Flutie? Then I'm thinking of Doug Flutie.
He is also a quarterback. He played for the Chargers, maybe.
Doug Flutie, 21 seasons.
He probably played for a couple people then.
12, but only 12 in the NFL. Who do you play for? The Bears and the Patriots, and then the Bills, and then the Chargers, and then the Patriots.
I was going to say, wasn't Doug Flutie the guy who Tom Brady took over for?
That was Drew Bledsoe.
Oh, Drew Bledsoe.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is totally irrelevant to what we were talking about.
A bit of a tangent.
He also played 9 years in the Canadian Football League, in case you care.
Wow.
CFL.
Uh-huh. But there are things that I care more about than Doug Flutie, and that is your number 10 ranked Cyclone men's basketball team. And Kyle, is this true, this fact that you wrote down?
Yes, that is true. First time ranked in the top 10 in like the month of February since 2001.
Wow. I like it.
So since 2001. So is that an answer to our question of this is the best Iowa State team since 2001 then?
I mean, they've been top 10 since then, just apparently not in February.
Yeah, not in February.
They've been top 10 two out of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
They've been top 10 two out of the last 3 years at one point or another. And they were 11th at one point last year.
And I think I guess the thing that I thought was most noteworthy about that is typically this team seems to peak and then fades back a little bit, especially in the past 2 years. February has been a brutal month for the Cyclones.
You're stealing my thunder of what I was about to point out. This team is 7-3 now in conference, and we'll talk about how they got there in just a second. But do you know the last time this team was 7-3 in conference?
No.
Last year. Last year, this team was 7-3 in conference, and we all know how that ended.
Pretty well.
How did it end, Mike?
It ended with probably the worst showing by an NCAA tournament favored team ever.
Yeah.
Wait, I totally erased that from my brain. I was thinking about the other year.
You were thinking about the Sweet 16 year? Yeah. Not the year where we scored like 30 points against Pittsburgh in the NCAA tournament?
Totally just like blacked that out of my mind.
That was a miserable game to watch.
It really was.
While I was at work, that was terrible.
I was awful. Not having fun.
I had fun for like a 4-minute stretch in the end of the first half when we narrowed it from like 13 back to like 5 at halftime. And then you're like, okay. And then they like scored 6 points in the second half.
Yeah. That was brutal.
That was brutal. So moral of the story, and this probably should have been the end of this segment, not the start, but moral of the story, you should be excited, but the success of this team is far from guaranteed at this point. I know normally that's your role, Ariane, to say that.
But I just want to put this on the record. You maybe 10 minutes ago, before we started recording, were elated about the state and very excited about the state of this team. And now you're saying, oh, we need to contain our excitement. Is that what you're saying? Like, tough times are ahead?
I'm saying it very well could be, but the thing I wanted to say, right, is I was comparing our game-by-game offensive and defensive efficiencies to last year on a game-by-game basis, right? So last year, through all of conference play, Iowa State had 7 games with an adjusted offensive efficiency of over 115. This year, they already have 7 conference games with over 115 offensive efficiency with, what, 7 more conference games to go? 8, maybe? And it's a similar story on the defensive efficiency for this team, right? I think this team is better than last year's team. And I think if you go back and look into our episodes from this time last year, there were a lot of yeah buts on last year's team. Yeah, we're winning, but. Yeah, we're winning, but. And there are more there are less buts this year, in my opinion.
They've certainly been more convincing than the team last year as far as offense goes. It's been much more consistent. There have been a lot less games where we've scored under 70 points or even under 60 points and still won those games, but winning them the hardest way possible. I doubt this team is like bottom 10 in offensive efficiency, which, you know, felt like we were most of the time last year.
Yeah, and right, just again, using the Bartovic, last year Iowa State finished the season 112th in offensive efficiency. And this year, they're 32nd.
Yeah.
Now, KenPom thinks we're a little worse offensively. I think about 45th. But still, huge improvement from last year on offense.
Top 50 with this offense, if we can keep our defense where it is plenty good enough in most games.
It puts you, and again, I'm going to flip-flop again. I guess I can't decide what I believe. Those rankings historically put you as a fringe national title contender. Like, generally, the rule of thumb to be a national title contender is you got to be a top 4 seed with a top 40 offensive efficiency and a top 25 defensive efficiency, right? That puts, by that metric, this team is a fringe national title contender. Like, I don't know if I believe that, but people do.
I mean, that's, to me, if you were to, hearing that, I'm like, that's a hard red light. I mean, I am one of the people who's probably going to be more skeptical about a team that is not a blue blood or a national brand being able to win a national championship. I mean, look, your blue blood teams, now if you include UConn in there, those are the teams that you think can win national championships. And that's their expectation at the beginning of the season. And it's a team like Virginia Tech or Iowa State or Texas Tech where you don't think they like a national championship is a real possibility or reality. The reality of the matter is Texas Tech made it to the national championship game and lost. But yeah, I'm always going to be very skeptical of that. I still am skeptical of this team, but I do think there are a lot of great things going for this team. And the fact of the matter is, I thought the front half of the Big 12 schedule was a meat grinder for this team. And we've weathered the storm going 7-3, picking off some key road victories over Texas now, which we'll talk about, and then TCU. We've defended Hilton. And now the second half of the schedule definitely on paper looks easier, in my opinion.
I mean, it,
with exception to Houston.
If you look at the conference strength of schedules so far, right, Iowa State has played the second strongest conference schedule of the Big 12 teams and has the 10th hardest going forward, right? Where if you look at the other people competing with them for the top spot, Houston has the third hardest remaining schedule, Kansas has the second hardest remaining schedule, and Baylor has the fourth hardest remaining schedule. So that favors the Cyclones if they can win at Houston.
I mean, if we're getting ahead of ourselves here and talking about a week from today as we're recording this episode, but I mean, if you win at Houston, you're just saying hang on for dear life and you're a Big 12 champion. It's kind of what it feels like. Just don't do anything to rock the ship. But, you know, obviously this team is very focused on the matters at hand. And this week, after a tough loss at Baylor, we all talked about the heartbreak that, you know, that was that buzzer beating what could have been. You rattle off two great wins, a good road win against Texas, albeit listening on the radio, because that's what we had to do for this game. Mm-hmm. You did let Texas back into it. All credit to Dylan Dessou. That guy is able to score the basketball. He did it again versus West Virginia in their next game. Great, great player. But you let them back into it with some threes. It got dicey at the end, but Lipsy was able to stem it. And then you really kind of had a firm grasp on this game against TCU for the majority of the game, in my opinion. And yeah, it was just, that's what it was. It was two great victories this week.
Yeah, I think that something that stands out to me as well, I agree the TCU game was pretty solid throughout, nothing too crazy, but when I look at these two wins, Texas and TCU, I see a team that shot 77% from the free throw line, followed up by 83% from the free throw line. As we know, free throw shooting has been a big issue for this team, so I'm excited to see a little bit of progress there, even if the people shooting the free throws were kind of stilted in that TCU game. And as well, three-point shooting was at 35% and 42%. If that kind of shooting can hold with this team, it will be very challenging to take them out. I don't know that I believe that it will, given that has not proven to be what it looks like throughout the whole team, but definitely excited to see some improvement. And I would love it if we would, like, I don't know, make the floor of our free throw shooting like 70-75%, maybe not get into the 60s.
Yeah. Right now for the season, you're up to 69%, 69.2% free throw shooting as a team, which is okay-ish. It brings you back into reasonable-ish. You're back up to 269th in the nation.
Whew. I have to imagine that's pretty close to last in the Big 12, though.
That, let me see. That's going to be harder to figure out.
Oh, fair enough. I didn't know how they could filter.
But if I ask you, so Momchilovic is our best free throw shooter. I think we'll all know that. If I asked you who our second best free throw shooter is,
Curtis
minimum
Jones.
25 attempts, who would Jones. You say it is?
Curtis Jones. I actually prefer Curtis Jones at the line at the end of the game instead of Momchilovic.
Kyle thinks it's Jones. Anybody else?
That is probably who I would have guessed, yeah. Or Keyshawn Gilbert, I guess.
Wyatt, you want to take a guess?
Jones is the only name I could think of actually shooting free throws.
What if I told you that it's Trey King?
I almost said Trey King, there was that one game.
Trey King is 80.4% from the free throw line this year. He's 45 of 56.
Well, he made a three in that TCU game, you know? He's just a sniper now.
That form, I don't know if I trust it, you know?
And if he was down in the 25 attempt range at 80%, I'd be like, yeah, but he's fourth on the team in free throws, right? Only Lipsy, Gilbert, and Rob Jones have shot more free throws than him. And he's shooting 80%.
I guess, I definitely wouldn't have guessed that.
No.
So that's my Trey King shout out. But I also will, the biggest difference in the last few games for this team has been Curtis Jones, right? In the non-conference and early conference, you're like, he just plays too out of control. He turns the ball over too much and doesn't make enough shots, right? That's what we were all saying about Curtis Jones. He's brought his turnovers back under control. In fact, he's one of our best ball security players now and is shooting lights out recently. He's up to 78% from the free throw line. He's now shooting 33% from three on the season. His turnaround has brought this offense from slightly above average to good. So we need him to keep playing at that level.
I mean, yeah, I 100% agree. He was, in my mind, going to be the sixth man of the year for the Cyclones team. Like, he was going to be the guy off the bench that was the real difference maker, impact player. You know, a lot of people could have said maybe that was Omaha Ballou coming off the bench early this season. Clearly, we know that hasn't shaped and panned out well for Iowa State thus far. But Curtis Jones, if he is efficient and is able to score the basketball, he is a huge difference maker for this team. And I think what really helps when he gets into games is not just launching a three immediately. When he comes into a game, he is most effective when he drives to the basket, sees one go through, and then he has confidence, and then he can knock down shots. He has been a great second half shooter. I don't know if the statistics back me up on that, but against Kansas in the second half and against TCU in the second half, he was one of our better players. Especially shooting the ball and being able to give that offense some flow and some consistency.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that for sure. It's nice to have a little bit of bench presence and some rotation. Watching that KU game against Baylor, they didn't have one of their starters and they really didn't have anything else to put in. So it's nice to have a little bit more depth, and that has not always been the case with this team. I'll definitely be curious to see if this whole Trey King shooting well thing continues, even if it's just from the free throw line and not necessarily from three, although he does technically shoot a higher percentage than Keyshawn Gilbert, I think, so by like 0.1.
And I mean, the thing I'll say about Trey King too, you mentioned Trey King free throws. He shot 78% from the free throw line last year too. Granted, he was only in 36 attempts.
I guess I just made up in my mind that he was not very good at it, because no one else is.
He was our best free throw shooter by percentage last year, believe it or not.
Well, I apologize to Trey King then. Also.
So, but yeah, the three-point shooting has gotten, I mean, I won't say out of hand because it's good, but I don't think he's that good of a three-point shooter.
I mean, if he can just go, he went 1-for-3 in the last game. If he's going to go 1-for-3 every time, like, I'll take 33%. That's enough to just, like, honor it.
Right.
Then he can own those drives, right, if they have to respect his jump shot.
Exactly. Yep. That was the point I was going to make. I will live with three Trey King three-point attempts a game if it means that Trey King is open like crazy on backdoor cuts or dribble drives. Because he is very effective in that manner. And if it's a home game, that is a crowd like changing play when Trey King makes a big dunk or if Hassan Ward makes a big dunk, similar scenarios. So I would almost encourage him to shoot three times a game. But if you don't make any of those three, please don't keep trying. Like,
yeah,
we'll limit it there. But if you're open, by all means, take the shot. I think there are some times in which we have open looks and open opportunities. And yeah, we're trying to get ball rotation and get a better, like, quote unquote, better shot in the offense. But some of my thing is you do have to take the open shots that you're given because there's no guarantee. It's like the grass isn't always greener on the other side. There's no guarantee the next pass is going to be a better look. And as far as passing goes, sometimes we are very erratic with passing the ball and very lackadaisical in it still. And that's just something that, I don't love.
Then one other thing that I had just on the Omaha Ballou front, he is 10th on this team in minutes out of 13 people who have played minutes. The only people who have played less than him are Caden Fish, Cade Kelderman, and Conrad Holly, who have all played under 20 minutes on the season. Just... not great, especially when you consider not all of our players have even been healthy the whole year. It is just, I don't know. It is concerning for sure that we have not seen him integrated more into the system as the year has gone on.
Yeah, I think I mean, I'm going to look ahead to next year a little bit. We're going to need him to stay around and be a factor next year, right? Because if you look at our bigs, Rob Jones is a senior. He'll be gone. Son Ward's a senior. He'll be gone. Trey King's a senior. He'll be gone. Those are our three bigs. Our bigs are gone next year. We're going to need Omaha Ballou and JT Rock both next year.
I was going to say, don't forget about the seven-footer on the bench.
Yeah, we're going to need them both next year because – I mean, depending on, I assume we'll look for a forward or a center in the transfer portal too, but we very well might need both of them to be starters next year.
Yeah, because if we're being honest, Momchilovich is just a 6'8 guard.
Yes.
He's Grady Dick-esque in that aspect. He's tall, but he's not a forward.
He's a stretch four. He's not going to, he can post up occasionally, but he's not a post defender.
If in some way, if somehow he makes it to the NBA, he will not play the four.
No.
Oh, no. 100%.
Split time between the two and the three, if I was going to guess.
But the good news is I'm not seeing him on any mock drafts yet, so hopefully he's going to be around at least another year.
Yeah.
So
I was looking, and Mike, you are right. We're going to need him to stick around Omaha Ballou if we can, because of our signed players next year, we don't have bigs coming in. We have a 6'5 small forward and a 6'5 shooting guard. That's how it is recruiting class.
We'll probably get some more.
We'll get a transfer big man, I'm sure. But if your starting lineup next year is Lipsy, Gilbert, Momchilovich, Ballou, and JT Rock, like, that's again another decent starting five.
Mm-hmm. With Curtis Jones off the bench.
Jones is a senior too. He'll be gone.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
I thought he had 2 years.
That's
so I guess Watson off the bench.
Maybe fourth year senior. It could be Watson off the bench. Maybe he's a fourth year senior and has a COVID year yet. I'm still not sure. He's listed as a senior on Bartovic's page. So,
for as disappointed as I've been in not getting to see Omaha Ballou, I will say Milan Momchilovich has looked much better than I thought he was going to in conference play. I thought he would get outclassed by the size and the physicality once it got into Big 12 play. He has looked more or less just as good as he did at the beginning of the year. Maybe not big scoring every game, but that happens when you're a jump shooter. And his post-game fadeaway, the low percentage shots look just as good and going just as much. So it's been fun to watch him. He makes a lot of fun plays.
Yeah, he does. And he's clutch. He hit the one at Houston, hit the one at Baylor. I know it didn't count, but still, clutch. Anything else before we move on to talking about next week, Cyclone basketball?
Nope.
No, that's all we got.
So this upcoming week, first game, 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 13th at Cincinnati on ESPN2. The Cyclones will be favored in that game by probably 3 or 4.
Watch it's out.
It's tough to win on the road in the Big 12.
And Cincinnati did have Houston on the ropes this past weekend on Saturday. So not an easy place to play. Not a team to really look over.
And Houston offensive rebounds really well. So we're going to need to make sure we're blocking out and our guards are coming back to rebound the basketball. And then on Saturday, an 11 a.m. home game versus Texas Tech. And this is a game that to me is just as important for the final Big 12 standings as the Houston game that's coming up next Monday, because Texas Tech and Iowa State have two of the easiest remaining schedules. And right now they're very close to each other in the standings. Like, my guess is the top three in some order in the standings are going to be Houston, Iowa State, and Texas Tech at the end of the season. So this is a big game to jockey to stay ahead of Texas Tech. It's the only time you see them, so you get the tiebreaker over them too. So that's where I just think this is a big game, a sneaky big game. And then the last thing to keep an eye on this week is, this is sort of flown under my radar until I saw it today. Remember, the selection committee releases their top 16 rankings. That's also on Saturday. So I'm interested to see what the committee thinks of the Big 12 and of the Cyclones in particular. I think we'll be in the top 16, win or lose at Cincinnati, but especially if we win, are we on the 2 line, the 3 line, the 4 line? I'll be interested to see. And well, college basketball is in the thick of it. The NBA passed through the trade deadline and is approaching the All-Star break here. Aaron, you want to give us just some highlights of some of the big trades that happened this week?
We had a lot of trades, so I am not going to cover all of them. So we'll just get some of the bigger ones out of the way. If you are curious, feel free to go look it up online. It is available. One that is important to this podcast, the Minnesota Timberwolves added guard Monte Morris from the Detroit Pistons. The Timberwolves got Monte Morris, and the Pistons got Troy Brown Jr., Shake Milton, and a 2030 second-round pick. So that gives them a little bit of backup, a little bit of stability at the point guard position, which they are pretty thin at. It's pretty much Mike Conley and then some combo guards. So definitely helpful for the Timberwolves and should stabilize them going into the playoffs. More Pistons stuff. Pistons were very active, which is odd because they're just terrible, but they're so terrible that they have to try and just be normal terrible instead of record-breakingly terrible. They drafted for Simone Fontecchio from the Jazz and gave up Kevin Knox, a future second-round pick, and rights to Gabriel Procida. What else is good? The Raptors received Kelly Olynyk and Ochai Agbaji for Otto Porter Jr., Kira Lewis Jr., and 2024 first-round pick from the Jazz. The Bucks broke up their twins, and they traded Robin Lopez away. The Mavs got what they needed in a backup big man. They traded for Daniel Gafford from the Washington Wizards. They traded Rashawn Holmes in a 2024 first-round pick, which is technically the Thunder's pick, but it doesn't matter. But that's a big one for them because they have Derek Lively Jr. at the center position, and then basically no one worth a lot after that. So you're going to need a little bit of backup at your center spot so that Luka can have somebody to play with. Let's see. The 76ers traded Patrick Beverley to the Bucks for Cameron Payne and a 2027 second rounder. So again, just a nice backup point guard piece for a contender to back up Damian Lillard. The Nets acquired Dennis Schroeder and Thad Young for Spencer Dinwiddie. Spencer Dinwiddie was then waived, and now Spencer Dinwiddie has signed with the Los Angeles Lakers. So while the Los Angeles Lakers didn't actually make any trades during the deadline, they did add a player via the buyout market. The Knicks made some upgrades. In addition to already getting OG Anunoby, they got Alec Burks and Bojan Bogdanovic from the Pistons, and they traded away Evan Fournier, Malachi Flynn, Quentin Grimes, Ryan Arcidiacono, 2 second-round picks, and cash consideration. As far as how that really affects the Knicks rotation, Quentin Grimes is probably the only one they really care about, but Bojan is a big upgrade there, and Alec Burks should be helpful around the periphery there. The Thunder, I thought they would be looking to get a backup big or just somebody with some height to back up Chet Holmgren, since he is very small. But instead, they went for a veteran piece that hopefully will help them stabilize as they try and make a deep push with a very, very young team. And they traded for Gordon Hayward from the Hornets. And they traded Vasily Micic, Trey Mann, Davis Bertans, and some picks. Gordon Hayward is always hard to decide how valuable he is because he's usually good if he plays, but usually he is injured. He's been injured a lot this year. So maybe that will help. Maybe it won't. Hopefully it can be some veteran leadership in the room at least. The 76ers also made a big trade to get a three-point shooter in Buddy Hield. This was a three-way deal. So the Sixers got Buddy Hield. The Pacers got Furkan Korkmaz, Doug McDermott, and some picks. And the Spurs got Marcus Morris, a pick, and some cash considerations. And then the last but not least of the ones that I feel like I want to highlight, the Mavericks also added PJ Washington from the Hornets. So they got PJ Washington and a couple picks for Grant Williams, Seth Curry, and a 2027 first round pick. So they got a little bit of a tweener forward there to help out. And then they quickly got rid of Grant Williams, who they just signed this offseason from the Celtics. He had been great for about 4 weeks out of the season and then has been awful since then. And then oddly enough, if I am correct, this is the third time that the Mavericks have traded away Seth Curry. They've signed him 3 times and traded him 3 times. So weird.
That's
weird
amazing.
Stuff. Yeah. I'm like, you should stop signing with them. They do not want to keep you. But that is pretty much all the trades that I think are that noteworthy. I just wanted to get a real quick rundown, but other than that, we'll keep going. Yeah.
I was going to say,
All-Star break is this weekend.
Just as it stands after the trade deadline, team in the East, team in the West, who got better and who like kind of sat on their hands and was surprising that they
didn't. Yeah, honestly, we didn't see any big names move. There was some talk about the Bulls blowing it up because they're not going anywhere, but you didn't see DeMar DeRozan or Zach LaVine move. Talks of Atlanta moving a point guard, whether that be DeJounte Murray or Trae Young. They did not make any moves. So all of these names you kind of heard rumored and shifted around that were going to be kind of all-star, fringe all-star guys, nobody really moved there. As far as teams that made a lot of moves in the East, I think probably the 76ers or the Knicks probably made the moves that made them the best, but 76ers are also dealing with an injury to Embiid, and nobody's sure exactly when he's going to be back. So probably the Knicks got the most improved in the East there. And then in the West, I didn't see any moves that were crazy. Probably the Mavericks made the best moves. I mean, they're not necessarily at the top of the pile, but I think they did some things to strengthen their rotation and help them maybe climb out of that play-in spot. As far as teams that didn't really do much that should have, again, the Bulls should have blown it up, and they did not. The Hawks, in my opinion, should have traded Trae Young away because his value is high right now, so ship him out the door. And then, yeah, the Lakers had talked about a million different things, what they wanted to do, how they wanted to get better. You can't waste a year of LeBron, blah, blah, blah. And then they just got Spencer Dinwiddie on a buyout contract. So not particularly exciting in that aspect. And they're barely clinging onto a spot in the play-in right now at the 9 seed. So they definitely need to figure out what they're doing. If they're not going to get any more people for help, they just need to figure out how to use what they got better. So that's what I would say there.
Fair enough.
I guess if we're expanding it backwards a little bit, I could throw the Pacers in there as well, getting Pascal, but probably the Knicks, yeah, in the East.
Speaking of Pascal Siakam, do you see that Tyrese Halliburton assist to him the other day?
Yes, that was wild. If people have not seen that, just look up Tyrese Halliburton backboard assist. It was a pump fake to a step through. He threw it off the backboard, caught it in the air, and then threw it to the corner for an assist to Pascal Siakam, who must have felt all the pressure in the world at that point. That's like the most important assist you have to make in your life, right? You're like, it's up to me whether this is a highlight or not.
And crazy enough, Kobe Bryant did basically the exact same thing. Like
against the same team.
Yeah, 10 or 12 years before.
Yeah, so. Both at the Garden.
Yep. There you have it. Play. From highlights on the hardwood to another Cyclone star in the NFL. Yes, Super Bowl 58 has completed. Vegas was, it seemed like a great host city for a lot of people to win a lot of money and lose a lot of money. But at the end of the day, all around, I thought this was a very good game. At the end of the game.
In the end, it's going to go down as a great game, but really the fourth quarter and overtime made up for what was a meh game up until that point. And that game just sort of had meh written all over it.
Well, it was an entertaining game, but it wasn't a good game.
If you're a fan of punting, great game. Amazing game. And especially
even because you had like muff punts galore. Like nobody did anything well.
There was one really good punter. It's one.
The punters did their jobs, not so much for the actual kick returners.
Yeah, like the only reason that game was compelling is because it was close and late. It was an ugly game all around. I'm gonna stand by that. It was not a good game. It was exciting. It was not good.
I'm in your camp pretty strongly.
I was wanting to go to sleep by halftime. So
yeah, I thought Mike loves
halftime performances.
Played a board game during halftime. My whole family was over. We played a board game during halftime. It was great.
Wait, you didn't watch any of it? Mike.
Why would I watch? I never watched. I boycott the halftime show.
I believe that's what they call sarcasm, Mike.
I wanted to explain. We had to bring it up every year. We may have new listeners that don't know that you boycott the halftime show. It's It's interesting.
Yeah.
I and, like it.
Most and, ironic thing for a person to do who spent their entire college career being the halftime show.
But the marching band is different than the Super Bowl halftime show.
It is, because the reason I boycott the Super Bowl halftime show is not because there is a halftime show, but because you take the biggest football game of the year and you artificially extend halftime to stick the concert in it. That's what I don't like. I don't like the extension of halftime for it.
Generally,
That really gets me.
I generally disagree with you, but this year's halftime show was just a commercial. That whole thing was a commercial for Usher's new album, dropping on Apple Music or whatever. I didn't That's not fair.
It was also a commercial for his residency.
Also, I heard he got married after the halftime show. Can anybody confirm that?
I did not know that.
I thought it was like he just got married like a day or two ago. Maybe it did happen. I don't know.
Apparently, he lives in Vegas, too. We're finding out a lot of things about Usher.
All I know is my family got really sick of me going, yeah, every time they mentioned his name. So.
Good old. I mean, you know, they had Lil Jon there. They had Luda there.
Yeah, Lil Jon popped up. I'm like, all right, where's Luda? That's who we need next. Like,
right, yep, there's Luda.
There he is.
As a millennial, it was a fun time.
It was fun. But like I said, it was just an ad. And that kind of like they're all ads, right?
With the artist. Right?
But yep. This one was so obvious at the end. Like, this halftime show was presented by the album that's dropping on this music streaming platform. It's like, get out of here.
Mike, did you time the actual game time that we watched in the Super Bowl?
I did not this year, no.
Since it was a 4.5 hour Super Bowl?
My guess is it was probably a little shorter because we had a lot of runs, run-heavy game. Overtime, of course, is going to extend the amount of actual game time. We were probably around 16 minutes for that one, would be my guess, but I didn't time it. Amazing. Maybe 18 minutes.
And all the fools out there were complaining about how long a baseball game took. We don't complain about football. With that being said, though, I give credit to Brock Purdy. I thought he came out and played really well, and he didn't look phased or affected by how the game really went. Sure, were there critical moments in where you know, he maybe short-armed a pass or had a couple throws that were just a little off. That's kind of been his calling card throughout his career, both at Iowa State and the NFL. There are times in where there are a few bad passes, but you live with that. What I saw coming out of it was, I think you can truly win a Super Bowl with Brock Purdy. Like, you're not going to convince me that paying Kirk Cousins $39 million a year is better than what you get out of Brock Purdy. Clearly, at the price differential, sure. Yes, 100%. But Kirk Cousins was not winning a Super Bowl with that 49ers team. Brock Purdy still puts you in position to win the game. They were in it all, like, they had control of this game for the bulk majority of it, in my opinion. But again, like what happened throughout the playoffs, the 49ers did pull back from the run game in the second half. And I think that helped lead to the demise of this team. They started to get pass happy once again.
Right, and you certainly cannot blame Purdy for this, right? You had McCaffrey fumble inside the 30. You had a muffed punt, and
the
you had
next
your
play. Next play after the muffed punt, touchdown.
And you had your safeties just absolutely lose the ball, both of them, on that big pass play. Like, granted, the Chiefs fumbled like
two plays later, so that didn't really matter.
Right.
And we didn't even bring up the block PAT yet.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay. You jumped the gun there on that. Oh, Ariane. I'll come back to that part.
So no. And if you look at the Lions for the Chiefs playoff opponents, right? All quarterbacks who many people would just in a heartbeat say are better than Brock Purdy. Tua Tagovailoa, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson. Purdy outplayed all of them for their performance against the Chiefs.
Purdy's better than Tua. Sorry.
I was about to say, I don't know that I would say Tua's better than Purdy at this point. Oh, I agree.
The reason I say is because guess what the topic on the Minnesota Sports Shows were this morning? Brock Purdy's not very good. They were trying to make the case that Brock Purdy was not a top 20 quarterback in the NFL.
I was going to ask you guys at the end what you were going to say top, and 20 was not going to be my number.
What delusional juice are they drinking up there?
Right. And And they went through and did all the quarterback, right? And they even named all the quarterbacks as the exercise. And I'm like, when you did that, I got somewhere between like 8 and 15, mm-hmm. right? Yes. Like there's 7 that are yes. better than him, and then he's in the conversation with another 8 of them.
There, so give me there anywhere is an between undis-
8 there, and 15.
There's an undisputed level of top quarterbacks in the NFL, and then there's a second tier. He is in that second tier, undeniably. He is not a bottom third quarterback in the no. league. No, no.
Like, I'm sure I can name 12 teams right now who's got better court, but I'm not gonna because that's boring. Anyway.
Yeah. I think that anybody who is trying to, I guess that's just how sports culture works and the internet. Like, so many people were trying to pin it on one thing or the other. Kyle Shanahan's a terrible coach. He doesn't run enough. Purdy didn't do this, or the defense didn't do that. Like, people are acting like this was some massive blowout. It went to overtime. They're talking about somebody choked. They didn't choke.
The 49ers came down to one drive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was close the whole game. You can say, well, they were up 10. That's not like a lot in the second quarter. Patrick Mahomes has been down 10 a lot and wins a lot when that happens. I don't like the narrative that somehow this is a failure by the 49ers. It was a close game. They lost in overtime to the best quarterback in the league, who just turned it on and just became just an unstoppable force. And you just have to take your hat off and be like, what else can you really do? I don't think that if you're going to pin on one thing, you can't pin the 49ers loss on Brock Purdy. He played well, I would say, not great. But then you look at, he was only sacked once, but there were 11 quarterback hits in the game. He was pressured constantly.
That's what I was hit a lot,
and that's hard to deal with.
If not for Trent McDuffie on the 49ers last possession in regulation, if not for a well-timed blitz and Trent McDuffie getting his hand on it, the 49ers get a first down. The Chiefs use all their timeouts. The 49ers at worst case kick a field goal, and the Chiefs have 20 seconds with no timeouts, down 3. That is a tough position to be in. But yet the defense once again came through and made a big play in a big moment. And there are times in which I was like, man, that 49ers offensive line just wasn't able to hold up in some of the big moments in that game. And they did allow a lot of quarterback hits in it. But to Arian's point, you really can't blame anybody in this game. It is the fact of the matter that in playoff games down 7 or more with Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs are 9-2 in those games. 9-2, down 7. The next best quarterback team win ratio in that scenario is Tom Brady and his teams, who are 10-11. So you're going up against someone who's able to put on a cape and take over a game. In overtime, on the final drive, 8 of 8 passing. And running the ball in key situations. The game-winning touchdown was a play that they used last year in the Super Bowl against the Eagles that they didn't pull out all game until the final play of the game to win it. That is coaching that has been there, done that before, and saved a play. It is so hard to save that play, that little nugget that you know is going to work, for the last play of the game to win it, and you pull it out. But statistically, there are two things that the 49ers went up against in this game. It's just the Chiefs being great right now with what they have. The Chiefs capped off an incredible run, statistically the toughest path to the Super Bowl by DVOA. The Chiefs just capped off the best 5-year stretch in NFL history, matching the 2014 to 2018 Patriots. And in that, what does that mean? So those Patriots had 5 division titles. The Chiefs also had 5. Conference championship appearances, 5 for both teams. Super Bowl appearances, 4 each. Super Bowl wins, 3 each. Playoff win-loss record, 12-2 for the Patriots, 14-2 for the Chiefs, because expanded playoffs, 1 additional game virtually unless you have a bye. That's the only difference there. So they just went up against the start of a dynasty for the Chiefs, and it's tough. And the scariest part in my opinion about this Super Bowl, this was the year that the Chiefs weren't really supposed to do anything. Not favored against the Dolphins. Supposed to lose at home in the cold. Not favored to go on the road and beat Buffalo. Not favored to go on the road and beat the Ravens.
Whoa. They were favored at home against the Dolphins. I'm going to stop you there.
Sorry. In that part, a lot of people are picking the Dolphins to go in and beat the Chiefs. They thought they had, you know, the recipe to beat them. Mahomes did have one of the more expensive cap hits in the NFL at $37 million, and drops were a huge plague for this team all season. And yeah, now the Chiefs are just going to bring a lot of these players back again. You know, Andy Reid's coming back and Travis Kelce said he's coming back next season. So that's, you're off to a start. You're not losing many people on the staff. So the Chiefs are set up to make another run, and it's just tough for teams to deal with. You have to beat the Chiefs, and that's proving hard, a very tough task and a tall task to do. One thing that I guess I wanted to get your all's opinion on, I thought the officials were great in this game both ways. They just kind of stayed out of it for the most part, I felt like. And I thought that was really helpful for the flow and like the pace of this game. Both teams were just really able to play it out, and I didn't feel egregiously either way on some of the calls. So I thought that was a good look for the refs, that there were a lot of, you know, questions and concerns about them all season long.
Yeah, I didn't notice the refs. So in my opinion, that is exactly what I want from a game.
Yep.
So credit to them. You know, we whine and cry and yell when they're bad. So definitely I like that you brought that up. And I didn't think that the calling, there wasn't anything that I saw that seemed egregious that was called or not called. So that is exactly what I want to see in a game like this, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with Ariane on that. Well, officiating was very good. Wyatt, as our official aficionado, do you have any thoughts?
I was really excited when I saw Bill Vinovich at the very beginning of the game. He is an outstanding official, and his crew this whole year has been great too. So I was excited. I knew they would be just fine, and sure enough, they were. I did hear some complaints during our watch party about too many flags, but I thought every single penalty they called was very warranted.
Yeah, the teams just looked bad at the beginning of the game.
They looked so bad.
Are they not supposed to throw a flag when the team fall starts? Like,
yeah,
okay, it's fine.
And all the holds I thought were very, very obvious. The one that they caught some flack for as well was the intentional grounding call, but that was intentional grounding.
I thought that was the right call too.
It was so obvious.
Of me being a Chiefs fan, I was like, that's grounding. I mean, yes, Noah Gray was running back to it, but the way that it came out, how he was going down, that's a feel flag there.
I agree.
That's not a, oh, he's in the area. Have I seen worse intentional grounding not be called? Sure. But I was not mad about that call.
Totally agree. That's one where maybe by the letter of the rule book, you could interpret that as not being intentional grounding. But in the spirit of the rule, that's intentional grounding.
The only one that I thought it mid-game where I was like, I really wish they would have taken a look at that because I wasn't sure on it, was the Kyle Juszczyk catch where he went to the ground and the ground caused the fumble or caused loss of control. But I just thought it deserved a look. I wasn't saying it should be overturned, but I figured it deserved a look for confirmation at least.
We talked through that one in detail at my watch party. And what we said, right, is what happened there, right, is they said they ruled that he was not going to the ground when he caught the ball, right? So if you're not going to the ground when you're catching the ball, then you don't need to survive the ground as long as you take either three steps or make two steps and a football move. On that one, you can clearly say he makes two steps, dives forward for the first down. So the dive and the reach is the football move that is then giving him that is a catch.
Which is fair for me. I wasn't saying, you know, that shouldn't have been a catch. I just thought it was close enough that I thought they could have gone and reviewed it to confirm. But, or I guess in that scenario, we Chiefs probably would have had to have challenged. Any other thoughts before I have two more closing thoughts? And then my one baffling thing.
Go for it.
Go for it.
So an additional fun fact, Chiefs defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo is now the first offensive or defensive coordinator in NFL history to win four Super Bowls, three with the Chiefs, one against the Patriots, the New York, and he was the defensive coordinator with the Giants against that undefeated Patriots team, took them down. So that is a fun fact. Secondly, Harrison Butker, in my opinion, could have very well deserved like a postseason MVP award. 2 50-yard plus field goals in the Super Bowl, the longest field goal in Super Bowl history at 57 yards. This season, Harrison Butker missed 2 field goals. He was 44 of 46, 95.7%, 15 of 15 on field goals of 40 plus, 7 of 7 on field goals of 50 plus, and 46 of 46 on extra points. The benchmark for consistency this season. And then I guess I had 3 points. Finally, what I was going to get back to was this game changed at one critical moment, the blocked extra point. And what that did was, instead of, I think the 49ers would have been up 17 to 13. Instead of the 49ers kicking a field goal to go up 19 to 16, it could have been 20 to 16. And the Chiefs are forced to score a touchdown rather than go get a field goal to tie the game and send it to overtime. That changes the entire complexity of the game at the end of the game.
Do keep in mind,
changes the play calling as well.
Do keep in mind, though, that the Chiefs would have had two, right? The Chiefs kicked a field goal, and then the Niners kicked a field goal, and then the Chiefs kicked another field goal there, right? Both of those Chiefs field goals would have been go for the end zone drives instead. So, right. Yes, that was big, but I don't think it was as big as some people are making it out to be. Well, mixed extra point was the difference between overtime and not. I mean, not really, because the Chiefs don't kick those field goals if it's not to tie, right? They go for touchdowns in the lead. So I'm of the opinion, and you guys can disagree with me on that, that I would rather be up 3 with a minute left. Presuming I don't have the ball, I'd rather be up 3 than up 4 with a minute left 100% of the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's much more comfortable.
Yes. Yeah, it's safe. It's safer because, you know, you can't, at worst, you're tied. Or I guess at best, you're tied. At worst, you got to go.
At worst, they score, right?
Yeah, but
the same pressure is not there on that team, right? You'd have to really lay an egg for it to backfire on you.
Yeah, they're going to take their foot off the gas just a little bit and maybe settle for a field goal in a situation where they don't have to. So, yeah, I always like to, I would prefer to be up 3 than 4. Now, obviously, I'd prefer to be up 7 than 3, but anyway, what was your last point?
I guess I have a hot take here. I'd rather be up 7 than be up 8, because I feel like when you're up 8, teams always seem to make that 2-point conversion.
But so you still just tie. That's fine.
I know.
Yeah, I'd rather be up 8 than 7. That one makes absolutely sense.
I just like 7. It's a nice round number in football terms. Well, so what? My one baffling thing is I say that I get a notification. We all did. The 49ers didn't know overtime rules. Multiple players said after the Super Bowl that they didn't realize playoff overtime rules were different than the regular season, which is why the 49ers won the toss and took the football. That makes more sense with this report. But with the new overtime rules, it is an advantage to know what the other team did. Just like in college, you have an advantage when you go second, when you possess the ball second in your overtime period.
Here's the counter, though, Kyle. Unlike in college, right, the third possession is to win, though, then, right? When college, the third possession, the other team still gets a chance, right? And that's what Shanahan said after the game. He knew the rules, right? Some of the players didn't, but Shanahan did. And he chose to take the ball because that third possession is for the win, right? So it's going to take a little bit long, right? It's a little bit longer, but you get the first chance at a score and you win possession.
But here's how the second team plays it out once they know what happened. They have now four downs in each possession.
Sure.
Because you're going for it on fourth down no matter what.
But not at certain parts of the field, right? If the Chiefs would have had a fourth down at San Francisco's 30, they're kicking the field goal to tie the game, 100%. Right? Of course they're going to go.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Depending on the distance, right? Fourth and one, maybe not. But fourth and four, yeah, they're going to kick the field goal and tie the game.
I guess if you're the Chiefs at that point, you truly do think that second possession is your final possession of the game, and you're just going to go try and win it. That's how I viewed that part of it. I'd rather go second. And Mahomes said that their whole philosophy was if they won the toss, they were gonna kick and take the ball second.
The analytics say you should take the ball first still in the NFL. That's all I'm gonna say.
If I'm being honest, I think that this is an interesting rule and I like how it played out because I don't think that there is a right or wrong choice.
I think there are value to both.
I agree with what Kyle is saying. It's nice to have the information. And it's good to feel like you know exactly what you need to do. But at the same time, don't you kind of want that option at sudden death? Like, would you really want Patrick Mahomes to have that chance to just kill you no matter what? I think it just depends on how you feel about your team and your opponent's team. And I like that that is the way. It's not just like, oh, of course, you won the coin toss. You know exactly what you're going to do. I think that these overtime rules are a vast improvement than what they had, obviously.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, it was the whatever AFC championship game.
Anything's better than what they had.
It changed those playoff rules for the better, we'll say here. So
the Chiefs were like, we know the rule. We're the reason the rule exists.
Uh-huh. And then there was a snide comment after the game. They were like, all right, which rule are we changing next now? So there you have it. Parade in Kansas City on Wednesday. I will not be in attendance to that. But I'll be watching online. So I hope everybody enjoys their time. All the kids are getting out of school. So we just left it set up from last year. Do it again next year. And with that, since we did just have a riveting conversation and discussion about overtime, Mike, what are these new rules for overtime? I think Kyle Juszczyk definitely can use some enlightenment, even though he is from Harvard.
Yeah, so, I mean, we covered most of them, right? The first one is that both teams have the opportunity to possess the ball no matter what, right? In the playoffs only, right? We covered that one. The other one that I know a lot of people getting worked off with, it really is just quarters, right? If that clock would have ran out, I know it didn't. If that overtime clock would have ran out before the end of that Chiefs possession, we just take a 2-minute break. And then we pick up from where we left off, just like it was like the end of the first quarter, right? We pick up where we left off.
I did not actually put that together. I thought it was you had if you were tied again at the end of it, then you go to another quarter.
Nope. So you would, as long as both teams have had the opportunity to possess the ball. Since the Chiefs hadn't finished that possession, then then they would have just gotten to pick up where they left off. So they didn't, that's why the Chiefs didn't use any of their timeouts, right? They wouldn't have, right? Obviously, if the game would have been over, had the Chiefs not scored, they would have been used those timeouts. They had two timeouts left at the end of the game. That's the other thing to note is it's really just like the first quarter. And that's why there was no 2-minute warning either. It really is just like a true first quarter. And then, again, the second one is just like another quarter. You don't have a halftime after the second overtime either. After the fourth overtime, if you're still tied, you would have another coin toss. So that's the only true one where you don't just pick up where you left off. But other than that, all the other rules are the same. Replays up in the booth, no challenges. You've got your timeouts. After both teams have chance to possess the ball, first team to score wins. A safety, though, ends overtime right away, just so you guys know. So safety ends the game.
any defensive or, score in
the game. Yeah, I was going to say just any defensive score wins the game.
But, right, a defensive score is technically both teams possessing the ball.
Sure.
Where safety isn't.
Sure.
So, yeah. Other than that, I mean, I think we sort of covered everything when we were talking about the strategy. Do you, any of you three have any questions about the overtime rules? Something you still like that doesn't quite make sense after the game?
Nope. Just sudden death after both teams possess.
Yep, makes sense.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. We will move right along to our Write That Down prediction segment, starting with a gigantic accountability session at the end of the year. I'm going to run through this kind of rapid fire. So here we go. Ariane, you predicted both quarterbacks would throw an interception in the Super Bowl. Did either of them?
Mahomes did.
Mahomes did. Purdy did not. So either way, you are wrong. So, nah. And you also said the Super Bowl would be decided by 10 or more points, which can't happen in overtime. So, nah.
Nah.
I predicted the Super Bowl is a one-score game, which it has to be in overtime. So, ding-ding-ding-ding.
Ding-ding.
Josh predicted that the 49ers will win the Super Bowl, which they did not. So, nah.
Nah.
Josh predicted that Purdy would have more passing yards than Mahomes. Mahomes ended up with more. So, nah.
Nah.
Wyatt, you predicted that Purdy would be top five in QBR at the end of the 2023 season, which he was number one in QBR. We gave you a home run for that, and you get a ding-ding-ding-ding.
Ding-ding-ding.
But it got worse from here because you predicted that there would be a one-point safety this year, which there was not. So, nah.
Nah.
You predicted that Dan Campbell would be the coach of the year, but Kevin Stefanski was, so nah.
Nah.
You predicted Purdy would be the MVP, but Lamar Jackson was, so nah.
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 And you predicted that Brock Purdy would be the Super Bowl MVP, which he may have been had they won, but they didn't win, and it was Pat Mahomes, so nah.
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 But you did redeem yourself by saying that Christian McCaffrey would have no rush TDs in the Super Bowl, which he had a receiving TD from Jennings, not from Purdy, but he did not have a rushing TD. So, ding-ding-ding-ding.
Ding-ding-ding.
Kyle, moving on to your bad predictions. You said that Trevor Lawrence would win the NFL MVP. We already talked about how that didn't happen, so nah.
Nah.
You said Mike Evans would be a Chief by the end of the year, which I probably could have taken off the board a long time ago, but I just waited till the end of the year. So, nah.
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 You said Kelce will have three more games this season with two or more TDs. He only had two of those. So, nah.
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 And you said the Chiefs would record three or more sacks in the Super Bowl. They had one sack in the end. They did get a lot of pressure on Purdy, but only one sack in the end. So, nah.
Nah. Nah.
And you predicted that Rashee Rice would have two or more total touchdowns in the Super Bowl, and he did not. So, nah.
Nah.
Nah. Nah.
0-5 from you, Kyle. 0-5. All right, Ian, you want to start getting some predictions back on the board?
Yeah. Ever the eternal optimist, I am. I'm going to go ahead and jump back in with the Cyclone men's team, and I'm going to say that the men's Cyclones basketball team will not make it past the first weekend of March Madness.
Ooh.
So I've got some numbers for this. So if you use Bartovic's, you can either use their similar resume tool or their similar profile tool. So historically, what teams have been around where the Cyclones are at now. If you use teams that have a similar resume to Iowa State, they average a 2.4 seed and average exactly two wins in the NCAA tournament.
Mm.
If you look for similar profiles, they average about a 5 seed, but they average actually 2.6 wins, which is interesting. So generally teams with our resume do better, but have worse seeds, which is interesting. But that is average wins is helped by the most similar team to us being the 2013 Louisville team that won the national championship. So,
so that makes it seem like his prediction's unlikely, right?
I mean,
I wouldn't say drastically unlikely.
If the average is two wins, that means there's a 50-50 chance that we get less than two or more than two. So this is a single.
I guess.
That's what the numbers say to me.
Sure.
Okie doke.
I am going to also predict on the Cyclone men's team, and I'm going to predict that they play their first and second round games, if it happens, in Omaha. which would be the closest location for them.
Do we know what game, like what seeds will actually play in Omaha?
It just depends on where, right? Basically the ones and two seeds are likely to get to play at the site closest to campus if possible. And then after that, it depends on how it shakes out for three seeds and going forward from there. So right now, most of the bracketologies that I saw today had Iowa State as a three seed going to Omaha, because not very many of the top teams want to go to Omaha. If we look at host sites, right, Purdue wants to go to Indianapolis, Connecticut wants to go to New York City, Houston wants to go to Memphis, Arizona wants to go to Salt Lake City, Tennessee wants to go to Memphis, North Carolina wants to go to Raleigh, Marquette wants to go to Indianapolis, Kansas wants to go to Omaha, Baylor wants to go to Memphis, we want to go to Omaha, right? So there's just not a lot of teams that want to go to Omaha, which is fair because there aren't a lot of teams close to Omaha.
So
I guess it depends. I was gonna say single, because it depends on how Iowa State like shapes up in the rankings and the metrics compared to Kansas.
If we finish ahead of Kansas, we will almost assuredly go to Omaha. If we don't, we'll see.
I'm single.
Single.
Because we heard about strength of record.
Sounds like a single it is.
Do we have anything from Josh this week? Is he still alive?
He is. He is still alive, recovering after that tough Brock Purdy loss in the Super Bowl. But he's not going to make a prediction this week, he said. He's going to take the strikeout.
All right, I'll go ahead and predict that men's basketball will make it to the Elite Eight or beyond. I already have a Sweet 16 prediction out there, and I just have to get my annual Elite Eight in there as well.
Is this a double or a triple?
Give me a triple.
Aryan wants triple. I think I'm fine with triple as well.
Doesn't matter with me then. I was going to say a double.
All right, triple it is.
What do you got, Kyle?
I have two. Throw it up on the board. Just get it up on there. You doubted them all season long. I was even there in the doubt. Chiefs win the Super Bowl next season.
Home run.
Next season?
They're the odds-on favorite right now. Nope. Sorry.
No, they aren't. I was going to say the 49ers are the odds-on favorite.
Triple or home run?
Home run.
Triple.
Oh, make me pick?
Yup.
What are the odds for the Chiefs?
750 I saw earlier today, maybe. Plus 750. 49ers were plus like 450 is what I saw.
Plus 750, I'm saying triple.
You're the worst, Mike. All right, Wyatt, you get to score this one because none of the other two know what they're doing. Four different teams will win a race in F1 this season.
I really want to see it, but it's very unlikely.
Last year, for all of our listeners out there, only two teams won races, Red Bull and then a lone Ferrari win. So I'm hoping for more parity this season, but I am much of the line of Wyatt here that there is not going to be parity. And we're just going to see Red Bull continue dominance. So,
yeah, I don't know. I can kind of see some light at the end of the tunnel. We'll see. I have thought about this one a bit since I saw it on our outline here. And I've talked myself down into a triple because I feel very strongly that this will happen, which means, well, okay, I'm going from the impossible to now I can see how it can happen, I guess I should say. So I'm going to go with triple.
That's all what right. I was going to say randomly. So sure, triple.
Triple it is.
With a
I really only trust Wyatt's scoring there. So
that's fair.
I did put a lot of thought into it. Well, with a strikeout, two singles, and three triples, that concludes our Write That Down prediction segment, which means we're at the end of the episode. Thank you so much for dropping by this week's episode of the 8311 Cast, episode 258. From now until next week's episode, be sure to check with our socials at 8311 Cast, wherever you find us. Signing off for the 8311 Cast, we have your hosts,
Kyle Mersch,
Mike Ludwig,
Arian Berry,
and Wyatt Teeter. We'll talk to y'all again next week. Go Cyclones! And Brock Purdy.
Go Cyclones!
Go Cyclones.
Go Cyclones.